Welcome to the Ag Future Podcast, presented by Alltech. Join us as we explore the future of farming, food, and nutrition.
Mary Shellman is the former director and is currently an advisor to the Agribusiness Program at Harvard Business School. She is an internationally recognized thought leader on the future of the global agri-food industry. A native of Kentucky, where she still owns a farm, Shellman received her bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Kentucky and her master's degree in business administration from Harvard Business School. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Do millennials really see the supermarket as a daycare center for the elderly?
You know, that's a great introduction, isn't it? It really gets people's attention. And I would say definitely it's if you stop the millennial walking down the street. And of course, we just for those that might not know a millennial, someone that's what we usually say, someone born between 1980 and 2000, maybe that group of people. That's not the answer they get you, give to you. But the idea came from actually my good friend, Aidan Conley of Alltech. And he was running a training program here in Lexington with a group of young people from all over the world in their early 20s. And he took them out on this visit to a number of supermarkets here in town. They went to Kroger's and Whole Foods and I'm sure some others. And he came back and he was doing a debrief with them and they were having a conversation. And he said, well, what did you think? Oh, yeah, those were great. Those were really, really nice. And then he asked them, he said, oh, do you shop? Would you shop there? Oh, no, we'd never go there. It's like, well, why not? Well, that's not the way we would expect to get our food. We're going to order it online. We're going to, somebody's going to bring it to our house. You know, it's just, so that led him to the question as well, then there's no future for supermarkets, right? And they said, no, we didn't say that at all. Well, what is it then? Well, supermarkets are really important because, you know, old people need someplace to go and to get some exercise and to have some interactions and, be able to get out of the house and move around. And he just kind of paused and said, oh, wow, it's like a daycare for the elderly. And that's where that idea came from. It's that this thing that we've been used to all of our lives might not be relevant for this next generation of consumers.
Speaking of consumers, those aged 18 to 34 are the largest buyers of organics, and they're the most likely to consider themselves knowledgeable about their food. Is this the newly engaged and empowered food consumer you're referring to?
Well, there's certainly a big piece of that because they do find themselves, they consider themselves very food aware, that they are very interested in cooking and sharing what they eat. But I think it's also an incredibly large demographic group. It's the largest demographic group now in the United States. There's 83 million millennials. It's only 77 million of us baby boomers. So when you think about this, this millennial group, that's now they're having families, they're moving into some, portion of their, earning power. So it's a very compelling size group for the food industry to look at. However, that's not the only thing that's behind this engaged and empowered consumer. I think overall, the whole country and perhaps the whole world is in the midst of this food movement. People just, they want to know more. They care more about their food. They want to know where it comes from. They want to know where it's produced. And the availability now of information is, and where they can get that from and how quickly they can get it has really changed their behaviors. You think about it, I was just looking up the numbers before I came down here to do this with you. There's almost 4 billion internet users in the world now. There's almost 2 billion Facebook users in the world. So information travels radically. And I was teaching in a program yesterday, and we were having this conversation about this, one group that was having a lot of influence, but it sounds like a very rich population. But someone from Honduras was there, spoke up, and he said, no. He said, in our country, which is, very different, kind of socio-demographics there in terms of, economics, people get information very quickly now, and they're all he talked about that there was engaged eating. So this consciousness is not just, here in this young person group, but that is a group that's very important, because of their purchasing power.
So we're talking about millennials and how they're rejecting the typical grocery store. Can you give us maybe just a summary of why they're rejecting the grocery store?
Well, I think it's very simple. It just doesn't meet their needs or it doesn't meet their expectations. I mean, how do they get their food? They order it online, have it show up to their house. It's the same way they get their music. It's the same way you get your, taxi now to go to the airport. You call Uber. It's just they have grown up in a different world and they don't understand why they should have to go and should have to wait in line to pay for something, have to wade through a store that has, aisles and aisles of things that they don't need.
I think many people view millennials as this enigma, right? They're demanding, they're lazy, or a number of terms. I wonder if that's your view, or more the fact, as you said, the way they grew up is different than the way that you and I grew up, and this whole other generation, and it's really a generational difference, and that the fact that change is happening faster, it just is that change has happened faster than it has in the past.
I think that's very true. I mean, you think about what they have grown up with has been different. Maybe not the way they've grown up, but what they've grown up with. You know, the Apple iPhone was introduced in 2007. So think about how fast that's changed our behaviors. They've just had access to this. They're part of this, digital economy. My son, who's 25, so clearly in this group, just has... And he's much more vocal in their beliefs, and his friends are as well around that. But I think what's interesting is that there's some very good aspects about them. You use the term, kind of lazy, and I don't think that's true at all. I think they just have a different idea about what's important compared to maybe what you and I grew up with. I think some of the things that are great about this generation is that many of them, they seem to be much more interested in health, and particularly so, than other generations. So they're very conscious of their diet and that link between diet and health. They're much more likely to exercise. So they're making these food choices based on, what do they perceive as being healthy? It's fresh, it's clean, it's free from these different ingredients. We'd like to go to farmers markets where we can see things and engage with farmers. But yet there's other pieces of it as well that make it a lot of fun. I think they see food as adventure as well. I grew up in here in a town in Elizabethtown here in Kentucky, and basically a very traditional family. Every night, my dad liked beef, so we'd have kind of beef 4 or 5 nights a week, and then maybe you'd have a couple of other things. But you think about the diets now, and the diversity that shows up. So one night it's Chinese, the next night it's Thai, the next night it's sushi. I think these particularly these millennials would eat sushi like 5, 6, 7, 8 times a week if they could. It's Italian, it's Ethiopian, it's Moroccan, So that's just a fundamental change in what they consider as part of their, their eating habits there. They've been described as food thrill seekers. Maybe you're at a stage that you can't, maybe can't travel because you have a family or economics, but you can get some thrill out of your food. And you can share this thrill with your friends because so many of them now, something, shooting a statistic, something like 70% of this age group takes pictures of their food before they eat it. And many of them, they share it on Facebook, they share it on Instagram. So food has become part of their identity as well, beyond just, fuel for the body and something that's linked to health. It's actually a part of who they are. And because of that, they want the food they eat to have the values that they have themselves. So you think about they want to be individuals. You think about the craft food movement, the craft beer movement, which was one of the first, harbingers of that, how successful that's been because, hey, if I can have on my iPhone exactly the music that I like, why can't I have exactly the same kind of curation of food that I like? The other thing is they want to buy products that, again, that they share these values with, that they think have a, they, you know, they believe in the purpose of these companies. So something like, you know, 37% of millennials buy products for a cause. So something that's like Rainforest Alliance, even if they have to pay more money for that, that that's important to them. And then kind of moving in with that, you know, 42% of this group say that they don't trust big food. They don't trust big food companies. They feel like that those companies, and even more than that, even kind of big farming as well, have violated their trust, that they haven't made good, you know, responsible choices, and they push products onto consumers that really have ended up not being good for them. You know, too much sugar, too much fat, too much, you know, unnatural ingredients in there.
So hitting on that point, it sounds like there's some big implications for the food industry. As you said, that perhaps some of the power is moving to the consumer from where before it was in the producer's hands.
Right. And I would say, I'm not sure it's ever been so, the producer in the sense of maybe manufacturer, big food companies, never been in the farmer's hands.
I think that's important to clarify. Yes.
Exactly. So, but that big food companies, the Nestle's, the Kraft's, the General Mills, this is creating a tremendous uncertainty for them, these changes in the consumers. And the reason why, it's just that the models that they have used in the past, based on putting it on product shelves, getting distribution in every store, advertising on mass media, big promotions at the supermarket, they just don't work anymore in order to drive sales. So those old models are broken, and they're really struggling to find out what the new models are and what the new products are that satisfy this group. Just to give you some idea how serious this is, in the last 6 years or so, and big brands have lost share in 42 out of 54 product categories. Last 10 years, between 2005 and 2015, the top 25 firms have lost $18 billion in market share. It's extremely difficult now for these firms to find growth. And so what they typically do is, the first thing they say, oh, you know, our products don't meet consumer expectations anymore, so let's reformulate. Let's take out the sugar. Let's take out the salt. Let's make them healthier. Well, that's great, but it doesn't increase sales. It might stop a decline, but it's not increasing sales. And then they say, well, let's introduce our own version of organic or GMO-free or, you know, gluten-free. But it's not getting back to sales growth, because when you look underneath, it gets back into this distrust of these companies. And so kind of that's forcing them to look like, who is being able to grow? So the opportunities that these changes are created are actually for the younger and the smaller companies. And it's these big companies are needing to look to them and say, well, I can't do this myself. I'm going to go out and buy somebody. For instance, so you have that, you know, General Mills bought Annie's, the maker of mac and cheese, you know, this all natural mac and cheese. Purdue bought Niman Ranch, you know, Campbell's by Boldhouse Farms, just in order to get there. But you think about the disruption in these that's being created. You might remember, so go back in your mind to the yogurt category in 2008. And you had products like Trix yogurt and Danone yogurt, and it was basically there, like all of it. You know, it was either targeted at women on a diet or at kids. And the products, honestly, they were disgusting. I just thought they were either too sweet, or they were had all these artificial sweeteners and artificial things. And this, we've got this Turkish immigrant comes in, Hamdi Yulukaya, bought this old yogurt plant in upstate New York, and can introduce this product to the market after spending like 2 years working on packaging and the product quality, but introduced Chobani. And basically said, hey, we want this product. It's going to be a great product. It's going to be great tasting. It's going to be this Greek yogurt style. And I don't want to have it a special product. I want to make it very accessible to the masses. But because of that, so he was on the protein trend. He was on the fact of natural, even though it wasn't organic, it wasn't non-GMO free, but it was natural ingredients. And he was on the fact of kind of the writing the social side of it. So, you know, using social media, didn't have any money to advertise. And 5 years later, that company, Chobani, had $1 billion in sales. 2012, it was a sponsor of the U.S. Olympic team at the London Olympics. Now, you know, Greek yogurt's gone from nothing to 36% of the yogurt category. You walk in the store, it's almost all Greek yogurt. And that category's doubled in size because you've got this better product quality there.
Well, I think that fits really well into another news item that I saw, that Whole Foods has had six straight declining quarters of revenue in same stores. In response, they created what they're calling a 2.0 version of their 365 by Whole Foods concept. And they're actually targeting it at younger budget-conscious consumers. They claim that it provides easier use, better grocery experience through a blend of design, technology, and experience. Do you think this approach, that maybe changing it up, maybe targeting towards, it's a whole different store. It's not even a part of a Whole Foods store. It's actually a completely different design. Do you think there's going to be some success out of that?
You know, I haven't been in a 365. I'm really anxious to, but just from what I've read about it and what I've read other people assessing it, I don't think they have the answer yet. I think they're just taking and kind of, you know, reshaping, you know, as the size is important. I think getting the size down is good. They can put it in more urban settings. So we have young people now, they want to live back in urban areas again to where they can walk. A lot of them don't even want cars anymore. So it's important that someplace that they can get to and shop easily and then get back again. But I still don't, the format that I think is much more interesting to watch is what Amazon is experimenting with out in Seattle. And they've introduced, they're trying this. They started it just after the first of this year, a store called Amazon Go. And it's basically, it's a store without without lines. They're trying, the worst thing about going to the grocery store, one of the worst things if you're, even for me, but also if you're a young person, is waiting to line to check out. And the way that Amazon Go store works is you walk in, you scan your phone over a reader. Then you walk around and you put whatever you want to shop into your basket and you walk out of the store and go home. And so it's basically a store without lines. They send you a receipt afterwards showing everything that you purchased. And I think that is, and there's also a lot more prepared foods there, which is another aspect of what, you know, I think everybody's looking for now. It's like we need help with thinking about what to eat. So that's, you know, a more evolved concept of 365. And I think that, you know, this case, it's really hard if you're an established player in an industry to disrupt yourself. Now, when Whole Foods came in, they came in from outside the industry, brought in something new. And now what they brought in were all these natural and specialty and organic products. Those have all rolled out into Kroger's. You can buy almost the same product quality there. So, but Kroger's wasn't the one to introduce that to start with. So I think it's... the formats like that, you know, those kinds of experiments are, be interesting to see. That's the one I'm watching anyway.
So what about ClickList? Do you think that's enough to meet the and appease a millennial?
I think it's definitely a piece of it, online shopping, being able to pick it up. I think that's helpful. I think that evolves. Because it's with ClickList, I still have to go to the store to get it. If I click Instagram or Amazon Fresh, it shows up at my house. And
I probably should have specified Kroger ClickList allows you to shop online and then go and pick the groceries up.
Right, that's right. So you order online and then you make the trip there and they put it in your cars and get it. And I think that, you know, that's been successful. Again, that next evolution of it that's playing out is, you know, where it comes to your house. whether, and again, so in this case, it could be, you know, Kroger making that delivery, even though I think they've chosen not to, but in the Northeast, it's at Stop and Shop, and Peapod is part of a division of Stop and Shop that makes the delivery, or is it Amazon? I mean, everybody's very comfortable now with Amazon. So do you trust Amazon more to bring you, you know, fresh produce than you trust Stop and Shop? If you look overseas, if you look into the UK, there's a company there, a supermarket company called Ocado, that you buy online. It shows up at your house. Largest online grocery company. They have no stores at all. So it's basically the supermarket without the store. And because of that, they can manage their inventory very, very better than you can, because the products make one left stop. So you think about fresh foods that come into the Ocado warehouse, or you think about fresh foods coming into Kroger. Often they come into the Kroger distribution center, they get split again, and they go out to the different Kroger stores, and you wait and you go in as a consumer, and maybe it's been sitting there for a few days, but you buy it and take it home, spends another few days in your refrigerator, and then maybe the quality is not so great. With Ocado, it comes into their distribution center, you order it, it immediately comes to your house. So it's bypassing that trip to the supermarket plus sitting on that supermarket shelf. So from a fresh product, Ocado says we actually have a higher purchase of fresh products, even though here we typically think, oh, I'd never buy a fresh product from an online experience because I can't see it myself.
So continuing down the theme of convenience, is also a part of this that the millennial doesn't look at food the same way we do, where there, you go to a grocery store, you buy the parts, you go home, and then you have these variable parts that you can assemble via a recipe into X, Y, or Z. Are the millennials actually also potentially looking at just skipping that part and going straight to, I just want that a meal sent to me and I'll choose what meal I want? Yeah. And it's already assembled, or maybe all the ingredients are there and I just put it. All I have to do is not think, just do.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different, you know, cuts at that are very interesting right now. First, we see the rise of these meal kits that you can order online, and it shows up at your door. And in many cases, there, so it shows up at your doorstep, and what you're getting in that box is exactly the amount of ingredients that it takes to prepare the meals in there. So if you have a recipe that calls for 2 stalks of celery, you don't have to buy the bunch of celery and then have, you know, the other 6 stalks right in your refrigerator until you throw it away because you have no idea what to do with it. I think from the millennials' perspective, and even from a much broader perspective, I was just reading a story about this the other day. There's like 1 in 4 households in the U.S. have tried meal kits now. There's like 150 companies operating in this space. Unilever just made a $9 million investment into one of these companies earlier this month, so they're getting some serious traction. The retention rate is very high once you try, because it turns out the product qualities are good. So you say, well, wait a minute, this seems all very expensive, you know, to have this come to your house. But the cost of that meal that they're sending you is like $10 to $12. It's not really that much. Maybe if you have a family of 6 or 8 or 10, it's, you know, that's out too high. But, you know, certainly a lot of, you know, 1s and 2 households out there. And so you get the convenience that it shows up at your house. You get the fact that you've really cut down on food waste, both on the ingredient side, but also you don't have all these leftovers that then you have to throw it away. But the other thing it cuts down on is actually choice. And we always think choice is good, but if you're like pressed for time, or if you really are not, you don't know how to cook and you're looking maybe to learn, but you're interested, but you don't know, then you want something, a recipe already sitting there coming for you that then you do, rather than have to look to a cookbook, right? Everybody says, oh, we're offering all these recipe solutions. Well, I don't want to have to look through those recipes and decide. Here it just shows up and you're getting your cooking lesson on top of it. So I think there, a lot of interest in that space, one to watch. Blue Apron, that's the biggest player in that, is now delivering 1 million meals a month. It's a big number, right? At $10 Amil is about a $1 billion business. Valuation is probably $2 billion. And they work directly with the farmers. So an interesting piece of their model is how do they decide what recipes to offer? Some of it's based on what consumers want, what customers want, but some of it's based on what's available. So they can find out from their farmers what's in season right now and what the prices are at different times of year. And they basically come up with what they're going to offer based on being able to meet their price points.
Very interesting. So to bring this back home to supermarkets, how do they meet the expectations, obviously, of the millennial generation who have a bunch of expectations, but convenience? How do they have authenticity and transparency and traceability from the producers, holding manufacturers accountable, and at the same time, as I said, maintaining the convenience and a price point and profitability through all of this?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, isn't it? Especially if you already have a big business, you know, a big business model and a big footprint that operates on a certain way. And it's just like, you know, death by 1,000 cuts, right? So, you know, one of the things happens is think about the impact of, you know, certain categories moving online. So now, you know, say people buy their diapers online. So now your supermarket's too big because you don't need to have as big of a diaper stock anymore. Well, you have supermarkets that are too big, but yet you can't like lop off a supermarket because it still means that the supermarkets that you have left are still too big. So how do you repurpose that space? I think it's a real challenge. But some of the things that I think that really need to be done is that, you know, one of them is a mindset shift. And we see some of this going on. I think for a number of years, supermarkets really considered themselves as basically our role is to rent real estate to manufacturers of food products. And we just display it. You work on your products and bring it in and we'll display it. And if it happens to sell, that's great. You know, and if it doesn't, we'll kick you off the shelf. And by the way, you're going to pay us for the right to be on that shelf because we're taking a risk putting you there because we've had to take something else off. And that mindset has to shift back to, as a supermarket, my role should be as a gatekeeper to this set of products that my customers really want. And not only am I giving them the products that fit their needs, but I'm also working in that store to create experiences for them. Because this young group now, and many of us, right, we have too much stuff. So now we'd rather invest in experiences than we would products. So how do you make food as an experience? How do we make sure in that supermarket, and it's certainly going to have to tell the story of the food product. That's the important piece of it. In Milan, a couple of years ago, there was the Food Expo of the World, and there was a supermarket of the future there designed out. And basically, you walked around the store, and you had all this augmented reality to where every time you looked at a category, and it was kind of, you could see visually this, you know, product information and where it came from, who grew it, whatever. I don't think people want, you know, shoppers want to see that every time. So I'm not sure that's the supermarket of the future. I do think people will want the experiences, the authenticity, the stories, the engagement. But at the same time, this convenience piece is really important. So supermarket's going to have to be omnichannel. So we've got a store that has some elements of this, but you also, it has to come to the house. And analytics, data analytics, you know, being able to really dig in and understand, you know, what sells, what doesn't sell, what price points, really have to go over the whole thing.
Mary Shellman is former director and is currently an advisor to the agribusiness program at Harvard Business School. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear other conversations with many of the featured speakers at One, the AllTech Ideas Conference, visit ideas.alltech.com. Access is free after signing up.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Ag Future Podcast, presented by AllTech. For show notes and more episodes, visit alltech.com/agfuture.